And our final guest of the night was the Malaysian chef Angie Branca. So she has a place called Sate Kampar, which is just a little place with some skewers of grilled meat, and oh, it happens to be a James Beard Award-nominated restaurant. It's one of the hottest places in town, and she just radiates passion for her food, and she joined me on stage. Now, what you need to know is that we put little cups under everyone's seat in the audience, and we finally gave them permission to open them up and taste what was in them. This was a way of telling Angie's story, and off she went.
So let me tell you what this is that we are all tasting. This is called acar. It's a Malaysian style pickle, and it's something pretty dear to me. I'll tell you the story about this pickle. But it is, do you like it? Do you like the taste? It's delicious, right?
It's beautiful. So this is carrots and cucumbers.
And it's pickled traditional Chinese method with sambal tossed in it. It's a Yonya dish. And Yonya is it's a cross-cultural clan as a result of an intermarriage between the Chinese and the Malays. That, you know, this kind of stuff only exists in Malaysia, and it started from the 13th century, a long time ago. It's not something new, but we have a lot of cross-cultural intermarriage clans in Malaysia. So that's why in Malaysian cuisine, when you taste it, you always get these really complex flavors of all these different cultures, the Chinese, the Indians, and the Malays. And these were the people who were part of the Marco Polo spice trade, that the people who sailed from China to India to trade spice in that region. So a lot of the cuisine in Malaysia since the 13th century and the 14th century came about from this era of spice trading.
Yeah.
So that's why it's so complex, and the techniques that we use is so complex. But the funny story about this is in my family, my aunt, whom I call Kuma, because I speak Cantonese, so Kuma is what I call my aunt, she was the best achat maker in the family. Everyone knows that. So every time we go back to Kuma's house, our one request is, Kuma, please make achat for all of us to eat, right? So when I opened a restaurant, I wanted to serve her achat. And in fact, in my menu, it's actually called Kuma's achat because it's her recipe. And I was here in the U.S. at that time, and I'll call my Kuma. I said, Kuma, can you please give me a recipe? And she says, yeah, sure, I'll give it to you. And she says, okay, you got to use 1 keti of carrots.
A keti is like a, it's like a measure
it's
of
a measurement,
weight. That's
right?
Like
very
the equivalent
old.
Of like 14 ounces or some. It's a unit of measurement.
Yeah, it's a measurement. It's a little bit less than a kilo. So keti is a little less than that. It goes 1 keti of carrots, 4 ketis of cucumber, 1 bottle of vinegar. You got, okay, Kuma, how big is that bottle of vinegar? And she goes, you know, that corner store, that guy who sells vinegar, you know where to get it from? It's like, okay, that's 1 bottle of vinegar. And here's the funniest thing. And she says, you go to the spice man and get a packet of rempah and some chilies. Like, okay, how big is that packet of rempah? Like, it's the same spice man. You know which one I always go to? Just ask him for a packet. And here she's assuming that the same spice man would always be there blending the same rempah for her entire life, using the same size packet forever.
Yeah.
And she's expecting that I should understand what that packet size is, right? And then she says, and 10 cents of turmeric.
So as a cookbook editor in my other life, like, this is giving me the sweats. Like, hearing,
yeah.
Like, this, I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah, it does. So then I told my Kuma, I said, Kuma, I'm opening a restaurant. I think I need some metric measurements here. She goes, what is that? And 10 cents. I asked her, is it before inflation, after inflation, like, which year? Yeah.
So you, before you were a restaurateur and a chef, you were an international business consultant.
Yes, I was.
Hence, you knew to ask her about the inflation on the 10 cents.
We'll be back in a minute with more from Chef Angie Branca. We're coming to you from Philadelphia today with an audience at public radio station WHYY. We were on a mission to talk to some of the people who make Philly such an amazing food town, and we're coming back into a conversation I'm having with Chef Angie Branca about her restaurant, Saté Campar.
But so you spent many years in this corporate life.
Right.
You didn't intend on being a restaurateur. You didn't intend on being a chef. How'd you learn to cook?
I learned to cook in my grandma's kitchen and in my mom's kitchen.
In Malaysia?
In Malaysia. Specifically, my grandma. My grandma lived in an era where, in her mind, the most important thing for her as her grandmother's duty was to make sure that every woman can cook and can cook very well. Because that was the only way that you can find a husband. That was the only way.
Old school, baby.
That was the era that she grew up in, right? And as soon as I could walk or maybe even crawl, I was already in the kitchen. So, you know, the day usually starts with making sauces and sambal. So peeling shallots was, I hate that. But it was my first job. So it was really amazing spending time with my grandma in the kitchen, because not only did she teach me the ingredients and the flavors and the combination of all the different techniques, the Chinese, the Malays, the Indian techniques, she had a whole different concept of how to plan a menu for every night. And it's really funny. Every morning when my brother wakes up, the first thing my grandmother would ask us to do is stick your tongue out. Like, okay, what are you looking at, Grandma? Now, I need to see what you're going to eat for dinner tonight.
Huh.
And
what does that mean?
So my grandma's idea of food is medicine. And, you know, the thing that you should be eating every day should be what your health needs and what your body needs. And for her to understand that was to look at the condition of our tongue, look at our eyes. She would usually question us, how do you feel? Do you feel hot? Do you feel cold? You know, stuff like that. But it was part of every day. My grandma just constantly teaching me different body conditions and how food relates to that, the yin and yang of every single ingredient. So not only did I learn the flavors, I had to learn the yin and yang of every ingredient.
Yeah.
And it stuck with me. And as I got older, and of course, when I got to the age when I had to take care of my grandmother and my mom, I would ask them to stick out their tongue. So I can understand what soup I should be making for them. That was how I learned. But it was a very different culinary education.
And a sense that your food and your well-being and your food mm-hmm. and your health are so intertwined.
It is, yeah.
You left home. Mm-hmm. You left Malaysia. You, like I said before, you were in business consulting internationally. I think you went to school in Scotland, and then you worked all around the world. You came to Philadelphia, and you had this high-powered corporate career. You had a career that was, you know,
I did, yeah.
professional. It was white collar. It was, yeah. I'm sure, if your family is anything like my family, like, that was the sort of future that they wanted for their child.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Why did you open the restaurant?
Oh, God. It drove my family nuts. Maybe to drive my dad nuts. I really miss where I came from. I miss what I grew up with. It's just something that being halfway around the world, with my family not here with me, that makes me want that more. Every single year, yeah. I just want that more. And after a while, it dawned on me that there were a few things that happened, right? I used to go back to Malaysia very often, and I would seek out the food and the memories that I remember as a kid. And every year I go back, I find that it's harder and harder to find that food. Mm. It's harder and harder to find those simple memories that I had. And here, of course, it's just not available. So the combination of those two things just made me decide, you know what, I'm just going to give myself some time, going to create this restaurant based on my memories, and just to preserve some of these. It's not just about serving food, but preserve the culture and the environment of how my particular cuisine would be enjoyed and the way I know it. Mm.
So to create your own little world where it makes sense to stick out your tongue and decide what you want to eat.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it was more than that. It was a lot of memories. I mean, like, okay, so satay, right? So my restaurant is Satay Kampar. So the feature is satay. And
little grilled
meat on skewers. And satay for me is pretty special because it's a celebration meal for my brother and I when we were little kids. Satay was something that, this is before Malaysia was westernized. This is like, you know, if you think back in the eras between the 1960s, 1970s, there wasn't even a McDonald's in Malaysia at that time. We didn't have a lot of access to Western food. So satay was the barbecue meat on skewers. Like, that was the best thing that you would get. So if my brother and I did really well in school and our parents asked us, well, what do you want as a reward? It would be satay.
Yeah.
And it would be a lot of satays. So we would go out to this, you know, side street stall where we can now indulge in satay. And when I mean indulge in satay, it means my brother and I would have a competition. So how many sticks of satay we can gobble down that night.
Like Joey Chestnut style.
It's seriously, we would be just gobbling down satay so fast and then piling up the sticks next to us. And then at the end of the meal, we'll be counting the sticks that we ate, right? And in Malaysia, back those days, the satays were tiny pieces. The ones that I serve in a restaurant, by the way, is 2 times the size of what we would usually get in Malaysia. It's still small, but it's 2 times the size as what we would get in Malaysia.
Welcome to America.
Yeah. But they were like tiny little sticks. They're very well marinated meat. And the peanut sauce is just, you know, delicious. And my brother usually beats me all the time. I think his top would be like 60 sticks. That'd be like 50, maybe, you know. But that is our celebration meal. Yeah.
So you open a restaurant to train, and one day you'll go to your brother and be like, what's up?
Right, exactly. Yeah. You know, but what made me really decide on satay is when I first came to the U.S., and I think many of you have tried satay. It's an appetizer. For me, it's not an appetizer. It's the dinner. It's the meal. It's, you know, you go for that. And it's so different here, the way you approach that. And that's why, you know, when I opened Satay Kampar, by that time, I've already lived in the U.S. for 17 years, or 15 years, right? So I understood that when food gets translated outside of the native country, it can change because it's so it's easy to create a recipe and to remake a recipe. Well, actually, it's not so easy because ingredients are very difficult to source here. But it's very difficult to serve a cuisine as well as to translate the culture of it, of enjoying it, and to translate the whole ambience with it.
Sure.
And so that's why I you know, open Satay Kampar to attempt to do that.
Yeah, it's one thing to make a recipe, but it's another thing to make a world around that recipe where that dish makes sense in its own way. But let me ask you a question, because most every other Malaysian restaurant I can think of, maybe in this country, serves, you know, all the greatest hits of Malaysian cooking from every region, plus pad thai and probably some sushi too.
Pad thai in the Malaysian menu bugs me so much.
It's like, you know,
you don't even get me started.
It's crazy. It's like, oh, like,
Don't even get me started. Like, why would you go to a Malaysian restaurant and order pad thai?
Yeah, no, it's like going to Puerto Rico and be like, where are the tacos? Like, it's like not actually how that's supposed to work. But but here's a question. How or why did you feel able to open something that, you know, people would think of as a Malaysian restaurant and not feel like you needed to do that or feel like you weren't going to have to fall into that trap of serving
pad thai?
Pad thai.
I'm not falling into the trap. But, you know, number one, I mean, I'm in Philadelphia. It's amazing to be able to open a restaurant with so much intent, and Philadelphians accept it. Philadelphians love it. It's where I am. I think it's a great thing. But the other thing is the fact that most Malaysian restaurateurs, when they're here opening a restaurant, the idea for that existence is survival. That was the one thing that they know how to do and they had to do to survive. So they're going to serve everything, hoping somebody will pick something. And if you don't like something, I'll make you a burger. Right? So it's the survival mentality for a lot of restaurateurs. I came from a different angle. I had a different privilege to be able to open a restaurant with intent, not defined by what you want to eat, but defined by what I want to tell you. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a big difference. And I think it's not just Malaysian restaurants. I think Asian restaurants in general in the past have opened because of survival. But now hopefully this the second generation, the third generation, and even restaurateurs like myself would be able to have a chance to open a restaurant where they intend to showcase an experience,
right,
which, you know, it's different.
Right. It's an opportunity
yeah.
for people to tell their own story.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Angie.
Thank you.
Angie Branca is the chef owner of Satay Kampar.